Happy Wednesday, everyone, and welcome back to episode 3 of the Get Hip Cast, entitled Change Request. We skipped a week last week, kind of we're on hiatus for a week while we had to get some stuff done. If you haven't watched the Get Hip Cast before, this is kind of a play on words podcast where we explore the intersection of technology and culture. And there's no doubt that amidst the pandemic and other things going on, social unrest, things are changing and technology advancements are helping us and hurting us in many ways. And in this episode of the Get Hip Cast, we're going to spend time talking about organizational culture and technology like we always do. And today I'd really like to focus our dialogue on change and how change within an existing culture can be difficult, how embracing disruption as a means to accelerate progress is a far better approach as opposed to creating dysfunction within an organization. So with that, let me introduce my guests. First, we have Mike Wojka. Mike runs operations for me, and I've known Mike for probably over 25 years now. And he's taken the operational reins of a business that I've spent the last 12 or 13 years of my life building. It probably has my fingerprints, DNA, and other secretions all over it. So I thought, who better to question on the challenges of being associated and leading a culture that you didn't create than Mike? And then my second guest is Randy Sperling. She's been a key player on the team for about 10 years. And today she reports to Mike. So I thought, who better to ask about change in culture and disruption than someone who's reported to someone different for the last 9 months, who clearly has different DNA and different secretions.
I'm so glad we're virtual.
So with that, Mike, why don't you tell us a little about yourself and your background?
My name is Mike Wojka. like I said, I've known, like Bridge said, I think it's been like 26, 27 years now. We've been friends, known each other, worked together way back when. I've been in technology for about 20, longer I want to admit, probably like 27, 28 years, through various kind of support roles initial early on, moving into kind of the sales engineering role, and worked for a couple of very large vendors for a very long time, probably for like the last 20 years, in the world of storage and SMEs and lead roles in the sales engineering role.
Great. Thanks, Mike. Randy, how about you? Quick introduction.
My name is Randy. I live in New Jersey. I've worked with Rich for, it's actually only been 9 years, but I appreciate the 10, the almost decade.
You get your paring knife shortly.
So I've worked in like project management, program management role for the last almost 10 years. So, happy to be a guest on your show today.
And Randy is a recently ordained PMP. Congratulations, Randy. Golf clap.
Bravo.
Finally.
All right. Thanks, Randy. Thanks for that introduction. All right. So let's get started. Let's dig right in. So Mike, we'll start with you. You came into a business that was built over a 12 plus year period. Many of the foundational philosophies, no doubt, are my doing. And I've been the custodian of the culture for most of that time, and I'm pretty proud of the culture. What have been the positive and negative aspects that you've identified in like the existing philosophies and culture?
Well, I'd have to say some of the positive parts of the culture is probably one of the reasons why I joined when we talked and when I was excited to join. I guess it's a team culture. It's a culture, I guess, first and foremost, it's always a culture of customers first, right? We are in a customer-oriented field, customer first, but it's a culture of empowerment, right? So anybody that is a part of the team and becomes a part of the team, you know, the big thing is everybody's empowered. Everybody's empowered to come up with suggestions, empowered to do the work the way that they find it the best way to do what needs to get done. It's not you have to do things this way. If you don't do this thing this way, you're going to get into trouble. It's like, here's a job. Here's how we need to get it done. Embrace technology. Think outside of the box. You know, again, be creative, and get exposed to lots of different, you know, technologies out there. Like we'll never, if somebody comes with a suggestion, we'll never say no, because we haven't done that before. We'll take a look at it. And that, I think, allows people to just, again, be free in how they approach things. It's pretty, a lot different than some of the, like, the very large vendors with very set structures have been, you know, in the past that I've worked with. You know, it's work hard culture, but work hard, but have fun, right? And team is definitely a part of the culture, right? Like, be a team, have fun, you know, and be empowered to do things. The negatives, and it's an interesting question, because I guess because I've known you so long, I've known lots of different ways that you think and approach things. But I guess negatives are, with that freedom and I guess that empowerment, some people might not be good or confident in that about themselves. There's might be some people out there that kind of need a structure, that this is what you should do every day, and kind of a little direction. And I think some of that might, maybe some people are like that just because they don't fully trust or are confident in their capabilities, or maybe some people are just like that and they still get the job done and they're still able to do it, but maybe sometimes they need a little bit of like coaching a little bit. I mean, not to micromanage. I mean, we are not about micromanaging at all, but I think sometimes freedom, some people just might struggle with that a little bit without guidance.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think the human condition struggles with choice in general. Like, while I may not struggle with choice at work and the freedom of creativity, I hate picking what I'm going to eat for dinner. Like, I hate it. I feel like I'd rather someone else just do it. So I enjoy someone else making those decisions for me. And I feel I get wrapped up around when my wife goes, you know, what do you want for dinner next week? I'm like, I don't know. What are you making?
It's like a limited amount of choices I can make a day, right? I don't want that to be one of them.
So I totally get that. Great feedback. How about you, Randy? What you know, you've operated within this organizational structure and cultural paradigm for a long time. What are your perspectives on some of the changes that you've seen? And what negative or positive cultural observations have you had?
So as I'm thinking through this question, it's like such a cliche to say the only constant is change, because things always change. It's inevitable. But in all honesty, it gets a little boring if things are always the same. But for me, it was a matter of how I have been adapting to it. But I guess some things have been changing over these times, especially now with the pandemic. It's definitely harder to connect with the team on a personal level in some ways. But I think as a team, we've looked beyond those obstacles that the pandemic has kind of presented to us. We are keeping in touch, you know, using technology, of course, and we're still able to connect on a personal level outside of work. So I think also for a long time, I've just seen change as a negative. So as you had said before in the introduction, Mike coming in, he's only been here for nine months. I've been here for 9 years or so, and I've always reported to you, or, you know, maybe someone else that I've seen, but that's been on the team for a long time. I think it was also a good change. you know, I really do enjoy working with Mike, working with someone new. We've built a pretty unique culture these past few months, welcoming Mike to the team.
Brownie points. Hold on, I'm right now. Brownie points.
But I mean, I guess it's not really a negative observation. It's really positive. I mean, I always fear the unknown, but looking back on how I've reacted, how I've adapted, and seeing how far I've come from day one of, you know, if this were to happen to me maybe eight years ago, I've been like, oh my God, am I going to get fired? Is this, you know, what am I going to say, you know? But I think it's just been really positive, especially over the past, you know, past few months, created some pretty strong friendships and even mentorships in some ways. So,
so you've been here long enough to see that if you were to look at our business 8 years ago versus our business today, our customers are changing. The technology stack that we're operating in is changing. We're spending a lot more time on process engineering and less time on like discrete subject matter expertise. I feel like the real value is like, you know, 15 years ago, if you were like, quote unquote, an expert at this technology, it had a ton of value to our business. Today, if you're an expert at nothing, but you're an expert learner, you're arguably way more valuable to the business because the pace is changing so fast. Like we worked on like, you know, Symmetrics for 20 years. And now the same storage array, switching architecture, it only lives for 18 months and then it's something new. So how have you like, and Randy, I know you well, so I know for you, you've put a lot of stock in, you know, your customer relationships. And I feel like it's been magnified during the pandemic, the pivot from deep customer relationships where the customer relationship was like the holy grail to now. Yeah. Customer relationships matter. They always will matter, right? Relationships will always matter. But execution is so, there's such a magnifying glass on execution because we're also disconnected, right? So when you can't keep that human contact, your execution almost has to get better in some strange way. Like, what are your thoughts on that? And like, do you feel that pivot from deep customer personal relationship to more execution-based relationships?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of our customers are also because they're working remotely as well. I think we found other ways to connect. I mean, you know, we have a few customers that are in Slack, and you know, every now and then, I kind of touch base on like maybe something personal in our lives where we kind of, hey, did you go on vacation last year? Just something like that. I think it's easier. It's been easier to connect virtually. Especially meetings now, turn your camera on because no one really needs to turn their camera off. But I've had my camera on in a lot of calls with our customers, and that's also something that, you know, I've definitely adapted to as opposed to, you know, just the WebEx phone call. But I think I almost think it's been easier in some ways to be able to execute on things because I have almost every customer at my fingertips virtually, if that makes any sense.
Oh yeah. Well, and
always in contact.
Customer communication channels are a lot different post 6 months sitting in your house. People have learned to communicate, I think, differently, right? Which that interrupt driven communication has, I think, for a lot of people, I know for me, like tell the story, you probably heard it before, Randy, but like before I had kids, like I was a horrible interrupt driven person. Like I had to have like all my stuff in the right place. Like before I started a project, I had to have everything properly laid out. Like then you have kids and you learn how to time slice like in like 10 minute intervals. So like working on a 4 day project where before, like if you worked on it for a half hour and had to walk away, it almost took you like a half hour just to catch back up. Like, so it was like that half hour was wasted. You actually get a lot better. Like I've gotten a lot better at like working for 10 minutes, walking away and having like zero loss when I sit down for 10 minutes again, which I thank my kids for actually, because they give you when you don't have options, you figure out how to adapt, right? Evolution. All right, Mike, I asked this question pretty much on every call. How important is culture, do you think?
So I do think, like, and I guess I can say this now, you know, with a little bit more, you know, understanding, but I think culture is actually very important. It's probably more important than some people really think about. Because, I mean, a culture helps kind of like identify like the common methodology for working like in a group, right? Like what is that common methodology that we should be, you know, kind of working towards? I think it helps know what may be acceptable and not acceptable in an organization. And if you have a good culture, again, I think good and bad is I guess it can be subjective, right? And good and bad could be subjective. But I think understanding what the culture is allows you to understand better how the team is supposed to work, how you fit into that team, and what maybe some expectations are of you in that team or in the company. So I think it is pretty important as a whole to have a quote unquote good culture, but also for you to understand what the culture is. And I think a lot of times people, especially I know when I was younger, I never even thought about that. I just kind of went in, did my thing. It wasn't aware, you know, everybody else around, you know, what they were might have been thinking. But I think if I would have, it would have helped a little bit more in some of the teams that I was with.
How about you, Randy?
I think it's really important. I think it's why I'm here, and, you know, why I'm here doing what I do every day with the people that I'm doing it with. I mean, that's bottom line for me is I do it for who I'm doing it with. And that means a lot to me.
So for you, culture matters most.
Culture matters most. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think Mike, to your good, bad culture, I agree. I don't think there is I don't think there is such a thing as a good or a bad culture. I think there's the root of the word culture is cult. And as long as everyone's bought into the cult, it's a good culture. How hard is it to change like a long-term, like a, you know, a culture that's lived for a long time, either change it or improve it, like, and put your own, you know, your own fingerprint on the culture? How hard is that?
I think it can be really hard, especially look, if you have three people on a team and all of a sudden you decide you need to do something different and three people can go ahead and say, all right, let's do something different, then okay, they can go and do that, right? I think now you get into like human sociology and philosophy about like, I have a culture of a company with 30,000 people in it, and that company's been around for 40 years and it's kind of ingrained. I think it's incredibly hard to do that. You're talking about changing a human condition in this massive, you know, kind of structure, because there's policies and procedures and everything else, and an expectation that people, especially if people been a part of that culture for a long time, you've designed how you work to be a part of that culture and accepted, and good, bad, or indifferent, not saying whether it's good or bad, but you've understood the culture and you've worked your way into it. Now all of a sudden everybody has to change. Now you have to change everybody, and everybody has to agree to it. Everybody has to be all in, and everybody has to promote this change and accept the change. And now you're talking about taking a whole lot of people and trying to convince them to change the way they've been thinking. I think that's extremely, extremely challenging.
What are some like key indicators of a good quality culture?
I think equal acceptance, ability, and the feeling that you can elevate yourself, that you can move forward, that you have a voice, that you can actually be, you know, you can talk with people. You're not always talked to. Kind of that collaboration, you know, and recognition. I think a lot of that is all kind of a good culture, right? I mean, again, working hard towards an understood group goal as well, you know, is a good part of the culture as well.
How about you, Randy? What are some good key indicators for a quality culture?
I think even just the length of time that you've been at a company, and speaking personally, being here for as long as I have been, I stay because of the culture. Like I said before, it's really the number one for me. Flexibility, inclusivity versus exclusivity. So, you know, if anyone's going to exclude anyone, I don't really want to be a part of that. And then also personal growth and development, just supporting personal growth on the team. And for me, I have 3 direct reports now, and all 3 of them wanted to get their PMP. It was no problem with the company saying, yep, go do a training class. Any extra courses you need to do, any course materials you need, by all means, get it done, and we'll support you through it. I think that meant a lot to them.
Yeah.
Also.
Do you think longevity could also be like an indicator of a bad culture?
You know what? It could. You know, it's status quo. You're really not motivated to go anywhere else or do anything else. I mean, I think it depends on the person. For me, I think I'm still trying to be better every day, do something better than I did the day before. But I think if you kind of get, what's the word I'm looking for? Complacent with what you're doing. I think, yeah, longevity could be a bad thing.
Yeah.
You're kind of operating under the radar a bit.
How about you, Mike? You think longevity could be a indicator of a poor culture?
I think longevity. No, I honestly think longevity in a bad culture just means that somebody is okay with their complacency and doesn't have the will to get out of it. They're just stuck, and then they need more drive. I think if you have a really bad culture, the stars, the people that have confidence in themselves do not last long. You know, and then you're left with a really bad mix. And I've seen that happen a couple of times.
I was having a conversation this weekend, and the person I was talking to said to me, if you can't buy nice things, what's it all for? And I literally looked at the person and said, like, so your objective in life is to buy nice things. When the last words that will be said about you will be, they bought nice things and enjoyed them. And I was just kind of blown away. And then I thought about it. I was like, you know, a lot of people think that way. Mm-hmm. And I guess at the end of the day, when I was kind of thinking up the talk track for this, I guess for me, and we'll talk about motivation in a little bit, a good culture is not having anyone on my team that says, that thinks about life in terms of buying nice things and enjoying them, because they're not likely to contribute to the culture all that much, right? Because it's just that very short phrase basically says it's all about me. And it's kind of tough to have a culture when it's always all about you. I think like the key indicator for me culturally is that, and listen, this is, you could take it as the Netflix culture deck, which says, you know, we're a professional sports team, not a family. You know, and to some degree, I agree, right? It, you know, when everyone on the team is healthy and everyone on the team is expected to show up at practice and play hard on Sunday, yeah, that's the right expectation. That's a cultural expectation of being on a high performing team. But when that person played for you for 8 years and has a torn Achilles, you don't just, it doesn't have to be that way in a good business culture. Maybe it has to be that way in the NFL, but in a good business culture, I think you create a system where that person can still, I'll use the, since we're on sports analogy, the Bill Durham analogy, where, you know, Kevin Costner still has a role. His role is to help mentor, you know, the next echelon of players. Yeah, maybe he can't play the game at the same level he did 10 years ago, but the knowledge he has about the game can help other people play the game. So I think there's more roles on our team than there might be in the NFL. And I think that to me is that's the culture of safety, right? Like when you can perform, you're expected to perform. When you need empathy, empathy exists because that empathy has been earned. And yeah, bad things can happen fast, right? And we all hope that doesn't happen, but I think there's just a natural trust and belief that I think is just, it just feels natural in a good culture. In a bad culture, it doesn't feel that way. It kind of feels like there's just a heavy weight around everything that happens, right? Where you feel like if you got to go do something, you can't do it, right? And everything is suspect. And to me, that's kind of where the culture starts to feel a little dysfunctional. When things start to feel like stuff's getting hidden or swept under the rug or whatever. I think like everything else can be overcome. Jack Welch has this pretty famous matrix where he talks about essentially culture and numbers. And in the, you know, it's got four quadrants to it. And in two of the quadrants, he makes this assumption that if you have good numbers and a bad culture, your organization's doomed. Like, this will kill your organization. But if you have bad numbers and a good culture, you'll get another chance. You have another chance to basically correct, you know, your course of action. Do you agree or disagree with this thought process? And probably the key to this question is, to what extent? Like, how much runway, like if you have bad numbers but a great culture, like you're out hanging out together all the time, like everyone's really smart, you have a learning organization, you put all these great things in place, but you're just not producing, something's missing. Like, how long of a runway do you think you get? And if you were to fix that in macro level terms, like, what do you think's missing there? What do you think's missing? Why is your culture so good, but you're not delivering? Randy, we'll start with you.
Well, I was going to say, I do think culture... I think bad number plus good culture would equal another chance. And I guess the extent of that is, are the people willing to make those numbers better? Like, are you willing to put in the work to turn things around? And it also will take someone to say, what is happening? What do we need to do to change this? So I think that also might fall a little bit on leadership, but I mean, if it was a bad culture and good numbers, on the other side of it, how long will the employees stay is the question. And, you know, you'll lose all your good people with a bad culture.
That's great insight. Like, because what you're saying is, if you have bad numbers but your culture's good, you'll be able to pivot and people will do what they need to do to correct things. It's great.
Exactly.
Insight. How about you, Mike?
I think a perfect example of that, and I agree, and I think a perfect example of that is Harley Davidson, right? So Harley Davidson was somewhat of a good culture, but leadership, like, I think there were different cultures in the company, right? And there was a culture of, I'm going to let this motorcycle go off the assembly line with a leaking oil pan, put some cardboard underneath of it, and just go ship it. And so there was that kind of, I'm still selling it, I'm still making money. And all of a sudden they were almost out of business. And the culture in basically of all the workers was, I mean, they, it seemed like there was a good culture among the workers, but not of the leadership. And then all of a sudden the leadership changed and realized, let's start including every person in every step of the production and design of a motorcycle, and let's hear what they all have to say. So it became all of a sudden a culture of inclusion. So they kind of, and here's a whole talk about changing culture, right? They changed it to a better culture, an inclusive culture, and they had a rebirth. And then, you know, Harley Davidson has been number one ever since. So I think the bad numbers, good culture, even if it's not there and you can get there, can allow you to change. So I definitely agree that I definitely agree that for the most part that that's true. Like, the good culture can rally, right? We talk about a lot. Listen, we have customers, and if something goes wrong, right, Rich, you often say, hey, listen, there's a fumble and we need all, you know, 22 members, the members of the offense and defense, everybody going for that ball to try and secure it, right? It's a team, it's a culture, it's a let's have that goal and make it work. And I think if you can get everybody in that mindset, even if things are kind of bad, you can change things. You can adapt, especially if you're flexible.
I don't know the Harley story all that well. But I think, didn't they, wasn't one of the things was, like, they identified, like, they became more customer-centric and identified who their customer was. Like, they stopped trying to be, like, everything to everyone. And they started, and they said, listen, we're Harley Davidson. We have a type. Like, we have a customer type. And we have a profile of customer that we're making motorcycles for. It's not the guy who rides, you know, a Kawasaki. It's a guy who rides a Harley Davidson. Mm-hmm. And rebranding that image, because being customer centric, to me anyway, doesn't mean everybody's your customer, right? It means in the same way that we have an internal culture, like, our customer centricity is 100 times better when we have a customer culture fit. When there's a gap even between our internal culture and external cultures, and we can't bring those teams together, I feel like it's hard to be customer centric. It's really hard because our cultures are so far apart. I think the Harley Davidson story is a great story. It's a good story about understanding who your market, where your market lives.
And they turned around and realized why they were doing it. You know, I think they lost track of, well, why are we doing this? Why are we making these motorcycles? Why are we doing it, right? And again, maybe a certain image or certain customers or certain ways, like, they rediscovered who they were, why they were doing it. They became inclusive of all the people working, you know, in the line and the design. And it's a great story. I mean, they were doing, I don't know if they still do it, but they were actually giving management training sessions. They had a whole school of what they learned and how they changed, and companies all across the country were actually sending, you know, managers there for leadership training about how they changed. So, I mean, they definitely, that culture has allowed them to come back and have a rebirth.
Yeah, I mean, as I think about it, we have, you know, I think we have other organizations that we work with that are very much like us, right? They're not, not everything's about like, listen, mistakes happen, bad things happen. And I think culturally our thing is, listen, something bad happened. There's a reason why it happened. Let's figure out that reason. Let's run to the ball. Everyone on the team, get up and run to the ball. Don't point a finger at the free safety and say it's his job to get the fumble, because he's the only person in the field who's been assigned the task of picking up the fumble, because it doesn't work that way. So everyone runs to the ball. We get the fumble, and then we go back and we watch game tape. And we figure not out how to not fumble next time, or how to recover that fumble next time, right? But the goal is to not point the finger on the field when it, when the objective should be to get the ball. But I think we struggle sometimes when we have people who are more interested in spending time. While that ball is rolling around on the field, they're more interested in spending time trying to figure out who fumbled it. Like, it doesn't matter. It's a fumble. Like, all that matters now is the recovery. We could talk about that on Monday. Like, so I think we do a pretty good job of doing that, right? Rallying and doing all those things. And I'm proud of that cultural trait. And I'm often like highly agitated when I feel like other people don't share that same cultural perspective. And it makes it hard to be customer centric when you hit those roadblocks. So I think it's both made great points. All right. So we're in this interesting time, pandemic, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. Now we're like, you know, things are sort of loosening up. You know, I don't really know what's going on. I have people wearing masks, I have people not wearing masks. It's very loosey-goosey now as to what actually is occurring in the world. You know, we've got like an unprecedented level of emotional contagion, largely fed by technological advances in social media and the internet.
And 5G apparently.
Yeah.
Article.
And in many ways, the same technologies that are feeding emotional contagion are the same technologies that we've used to like survive during a pandemic. I mean, we're in tech, right? Like, without high speed internet access, without a Skype call or a Zoom call or whatever, like, man, this be a lot harder, like almost impossible. So how important, you know, is technology within organizational culture, like adopting technology? And in past calls, we've, you know, some people have brought up, you know, this idea that like our team's been training for this. Like, we've been on, like, you know, we've been using video conference like at a level that most people just are uncomfortable with for years. So we're well trained to work in this, like, you know, secluded environment, but yet stay connected. What role do you guys think, you know, adoption of technology, and I'll even say like proper usage of the technology, plays in creating a good experience, like as we move forward? Because moving forward, I think we all know there'll be more remote workers, the world will be different. You know, will we go back to an office? Sure we will. Will we want to make use of virtualized technologies more? Absolutely, well, because we know it's possible. But when the technology is misused, much like when someone doesn't run to the football, I get highly agitated. And I'm just curious, like, to me, it's not a pleasurable experience. And I do want to go to an office, but I find that I want to go to an office not because it won't work well virtually, because the person on the other end of the virtual device doesn't know how to work it. So it makes the experience horrible. So how important is that going forward? And do you think we need to like invest organizationally in like training, like how to properly use Zoom, how to properly use, you know, how to not share your whole screen and share just the window you're working on, right? Like, these are important things. And like, what are you guys' thoughts on those? Mike, we'll start with you.
I think the answer is, of course. I mean, of course, right? I mean, like, listen, the technology and the usage right now and the understanding of it and the you know, just the awareness, right, is more important now than ever. because before it was cool, it was neat. Hey, listen, could you save money on a flight across the country and just have a video conference because you're going to need to talk for 45 minutes? Absolutely. That's always kind of been there. But now, I mean, it's forced, right? It's been forced upon us, and companies have had to pivot like they never thought they would. And some of them struggled mightily for the first, couple of months. I think, everybody's kind of getting a little bit more in tune to it, but trying to get on a video conference with 12 people is painful. It's painful. Amongst our team, we're pretty, again, we have a good culture. Like, we're in t-shirts, and we have the dog barking, we had the cat jumping up on your keyboard. I mean, it's all, we talk a lot one-on-one, and it's acceptable for us because we all have a good culture. We work together and we can still get things done. But en masse, with everybody, if you're talking to customers or doing anything with somebody outside of just our team, even other people's in the organization, and these things are distracting, it's tough enough to become used to this virtual world. It's great that we can sit there, I can talk to you, I feel like I have a conversation with you, but I think you'll agree, it's still not like us sitting next to each other, really observing, yes, we can see some of our body movement and some of our facial, and we can kind of get the emotion and things, but it's still not like if you were just hanging out with somebody. I mean, I think general humans are still social creatures. So making sure the technology is as smooth as possible, having the right etiquette, right? This virtual conferencing etiquette, and that respect for others, makes things a lot easier. And I know that you have to have some patience with it because, again, people are being forced at home. The kids are at home. Some people are just in really tough situations, right? So there has to be a certain level of acceptance, right, of that. And I think we all know. But I think, to your point, I think people just do not have the etiquette. A lot of people just do not understand how much that lack of etiquette actually is distracting to a conversation.
Yeah, Randy, I'm going to ask you the same question. But I think that, listen, you can't. Proximity to another human being has there's a vibe to it, right? Like, I have the same visual, like, response because I see you guys. I can hand gesture, right? But the vibe of physical human proximity is void, right? It's not there. There's no way to replace that. At the same time, I also feel like for the three of us, it's not a huge problem, right? You guys we're focused, we're attentive. We don't need to be like, we don't need that physical proximity to garner our attention. Now, there are lots of people who do, right? Lots of people need to get put into the same room in order to focus, because they're too distracted, right? In a situation like this, like, they're looking around, like, everything's going on around them. I believe that this should test what we define as a professional norm or not a professional norm, because I actually don't believe a t-shirt or shirt and tie defines you as professional. I guess it depends on what your profession is. But I don't, in our profession, I don't see it one way or the other. Like, if I was a funeral director, like, I guess I'd wear a shirt and tie as a sign of respect. But I don't know that we're in a profession that requires a sign of respect. So I feel like we do it because it's usual and customary. But I think, ultimately, isn't it dangerous to define usual and, like, in life, defining usual and customary has often been dangerous. And we're redefining most of what we define as usual and customary. And I feel like redefining the t-shirt as a professional garment is really not that big of a stretch, considering the other things we're defining as a society. Like, the t-shirt is like at the very bottom of the food chain here. Let's not get too hung up on it.
Oh, I wasn't saying anything.
No, maybe. I know you weren't. Yeah. So to me,
it actually makes things more comfortable in these types of settings when we have to.
To me, I think there has to be a dialogue around, can you focus in your work environment? And I think a lot of it will come down to focus. And there was an article written by the guy from Git who talked about, you know, work from anywhere. Like, whether you're off, your culture should be a culture really focus. It should be, if you focus better at home, work from home. If you focus better at a Starbucks, go to Starbucks. If you focus better in an office, go to an office. If you have 10 people in a meeting and you feel like the focus in that meeting will be better if all 10 people are in that same room, then get in that same room. But I guess it all depends. To me, it's all about focus, right? Because I've been in meetings where I've made somebody show up at the room and they do not want to be there. And it's like almost like, why'd I make this person come? It's totally disruptive. It would have been much better if I put them on a video conference, because they would have been focused for 4 hours and they wouldn't have had to spend the night away from their family, which has put them under immense stress or whatever. So to me, it's like, let's find I want to find professionally the area of focus, because I think for some people think working at home works for them, but they can't focus. Too many distractions. They can't figure out how to get to the office because there's too many distractions. But I think ultimately, if that's the case, you got a big problem, because that means fundamentally you can't work, because you can't work from the office, you can't work from home. That doesn't have anything to do with like where you're working from.
Right.
And I think we are exposing in this time, I think we're exposing some of those realities, which is, hey, I said I'd be better in this scenario. Well, here we are, no better. We weren't better in the previous scenario. Like, so what really is the comfort fit for that person? And in some cases, maybe there isn't any. And I think those things are, those will, I think that'll be where a lot of companies decide to spend more of their time trying to figure out what the right fit is for the employees. And if it's the right fit, then that person should be more focused, in theory, more creative. What do you think, Randy?
I agree. I think over the last 6 months on some conference calls, it's been a little bit difficult to focus. Maybe not for myself to focus, because I mean, I've worked from home before, but I think being on a larger conference call where people cannot find the mute button, or they can't figure out how to not dial in with their computer and their phone at the same time, it's a little distracting. So maybe after this, once things calm down, maybe companies will invest in some training for those who may need it. But I do think technology is a huge part, especially for our culture to stay connected, like our team culture to stay connected. And our QLife meetups every week have definitely shown that. I think if anything, we've probably connected a lot more over the last 6 months during the pandemic than we have when we were, seeing each other in person, because of all the remote people that we have on our team that don't really ever get to be there except for, once or twice a year. So I think it's a huge part. But to your point that, we've been training for this, pretty much our entire career, but, we were kind of made for this to be remote.
Yeah.
Work virtually.
You brought up inclusion and, I think someone brought up equality. In some ways, the fact that we had half our workforce working remotely and half our workforce who would go to an office a couple times a week or whatever, it almost creates this feeling of inequality or exclusion because, mm-hmm. you know, half your team's at a happy hour, the other people can't be. Or, you know, you have like this feeling of inequality. Like, is there more opportunity for the people who can show up in the office versus the people who were hired who can never show up in an office because it's physically not possible? There is no office in that geography, or you're the only person in the geography. So I feel like in some ways we've been a lot more intentional about building a more inclusive culture. And while, yeah, someday I'll show back, I'll go back to the office and I'll go back to a happy hour, I'm way more cognizant of the inclusiveness that the last 6 months has provided and the things I've learned about people that I've never really dialogued with. I'm also way more attuned to the fact that when you show up at the office and you're angry because you got a 17-hour day in front of you and you're just sitting at your desk and you're like, why did I do this? Like, that's a waste of time. Like, so to me, it's like, I think we're all in a better position to use our time more wisely. Like, because being there isn't really being there. Like, if you're going to show up in an office with five other people and talk to no one all day, like, there's no point. So I think we've gotten a lot more intentional about how we communicate and arguably more effective, which should carry over into, you know, when we have personal interaction again, and close proximity, it should carry over into that, to that time. Like the Q life thing, wow, it'd be a lot more fun in a room together. Like, name that too. It'd be pretty fun in a room together.
Yeah.
With some pizzas and beer. Right. But we never did it before. Right. We never played the newlywed game before. Right. We never did these things. And now, like, I think we'll try them because I thought they were pretty fun virtually and they'll probably be more fun together. The mute button, I think, is an interesting one, Randy, because is that etiquette or is that just lack of focus? Like, I have kids, I have a dog, and I'm on calls, but I'm focused on the call. And when the dog barks, I mute because I'm on the call. Like, I'm focused on that call. So to me, that doesn't have anything to do with not knowing how to use the tool or etiquette. It has to do with the fact that you're just not focused. Because if you were, you would know that that background noise is probably coming across your mic on a multi-party call and you'd shut it off. It's just you're not really all there. And again, I think it gets back to focus, right? Like, what do you... The human brain can really only focus on one thing at a time. Yeah, can you move from one thing to another quickly? Is it effective? Probably not. But to really focus, you have to be focused.
I see your point, that one. Especially if you're on a conference call and there is something that comes across your mic and you just completely disregard. But I think that's also, I think that part of that is etiquette though, because maybe you also don't know how to be on a conference call in some ways.
I think there's a lot of people that are just plain inconsiderate, and that bleeds over into this behavior as well, right? Some people just don't care.
I think it's a combination of all of the above, right? All of the above. All right. So, we're getting close to the end here. So is organizational culture something people fit into, or is organizational culture something that serves the people? And what I mean by that is, like, how important is it to build a learning organization where you get a new team member, that new team member brings new ideas, and you're willing to, like, morph your culture, right? And this kind of goes back to how hard is it to change culture, right? I think if you built a really good culture, it should be easy to change your culture if the change is positive change, right? It should be really hard to change for the worse. Like, hopefully, because hopefully the herd mentality keeps your culture healthy. But if you have a positive influence, my hope is that it's really easy to get that integrated into the culture and get the culture to be better than it was in the past. What do you think about that, Mike?
Well, I think there's more of a, it comes back to, I mean, I hate to use the word, but we're all engineers. Like, it depends, right? You know, if there's a certain, like, yes, the culture should change. Like you said, if it's for the, if it's a positive change, if it doesn't fully disrupt the business, right, as well, like, because culture is good as long as it has a benefit for everyone, right? So if you have a certain culture that's in place and it's a good culture and everybody's being successful, and then somebody comes in and says, well, let's do this, well, that sounds like a great idea, but that's going to disrupt all of this business that we've all, you know, kind of built up for the last 5 or 6 years. There has to be, I guess, an evaluation of long term, right? In general, yes, I would agree that, like, the culture needs to be able to adapt. Listen, we have a lot of changing times right now, and there's a lot of things that may have worked but might not have been the right way to make them work. So, yes, I think that they do have to change, but, like, not just change for the sake of change.
Right. How about you, Randy?
There were actually a few points, Mike, you made that that I actually had just written down, but I think as an organization, you have to not keep changing your culture, but be willing to adapt your culture for anyone that's new that maybe joining the team. Make it more inclusive. If you do have a different perspective, for example, be willing to hear those perspectives. You know, and like you said, if it is a positive change, be willing to see that. But I think that adds to the growth when there are different perspectives, when there is some change that might come in. I think that it helps you build your culture even more.
Good feedback. Would you think? You know, probably the best example, I think, is because it happens to be the one that, like, everyone's talking about, right, is 6 months ago, you had organizations had an office culture. And then all of a sudden, the office culture was just, couldn't have an office culture anymore, right? So now we went office culture to, now we don't really care about what the culture is. We just know we need to, like, we have to still do business. We don't want to have a going out of business culture. So even though no one's coming to the office anymore, we still expect you to perform the same, right? Because ultimately, I don't know many companies that can take 50% hits and survive, right? So it's not like, oh, well, the office culture doesn't exist anymore. Now it's a work from home culture because that's your only option. So because it's not our culture, we'll accept 50% of what you could normally give. I didn't hear anyone say that. Like, it was, we had an office culture. It was well known we had an office culture. Now we can't go to the office, but we expect the same level of performance. Is that an unrealistic demand? Or was it wrong to say you had a culture, which was an office culture, or should you had a performance culture? Right? Because ultimately, aren't we ultimately trying to drive performance, right? Now, if you're, again, in the NFL, part of that performance culture is showing up training camp, training hard, doing all the things you need to do to perform on Sunday. For us, I don't know that it's that black and white. I don't know that showing it up at a certain place has a direct tie to performance, right? And it's different for every role within an organization, right? And it's also different for different people within an organization. For example, we know we just hired a lot of new associate level engineering folks, and we made a conscious decision to cluster those people because we felt it was important for, you know, kind of peering people in order for them to kind of grow faster, right? But at a certain point in your career, the performance isn't always based on the same things, right? You reach a point where you have to do different things in order to up your level of performance. And in some cases, you get to a point where you just need an extra 2 hours of sleep a day, and not commuting is actually going to help your performance. Like, that's just reality. Like, sorry, but at some point you get a little older and If you need to work 15 hours a day, you need those 2 hours. Like, you just need them back. Maybe you don't need them back every day, but some days you need them back. You got more responsibilities, ailing parents, whatever it might be. And you're trying to leverage every 24 hours in the day. So to me, it's like, would it be a bad thing if people had an office culture in 3 months immediately revert back to, like, our culture is an office culture and we'll have learned nothing from this period of time? And would it have been, if everyone walked out of the office who was part of that office culture and walks back in 9 months or a year and goes, so glad to be back, and they found nothing redeeming or no way to increase performance in some way via the, we'll just call it a flexible work from somewhere culture, no way to increase performance given tasks of the day, would that be indicative of, like, not a great culture? To me, it would be, because I kind of think of, there's certain things, if you work in a factory, you got to show up. You got to punch the clock. You got to walk over to the smelter. You got to smelt the metal. Then you got to pour. It's hard to do that at home. but for us, it's not that way, right? There's a video online about the Amazon robotics engineers who, the guys who are, like, building, like, the drones and stuff that go around the Amazon fulfillment centers. And they had a giant robotics lab, and one day they couldn't go, but they couldn't slow down development. So, you know, the 50 people who worked in that lab drove to the lab, and they all set up labs in their home garages. And they're basically innovating on their own, like, at home. And a lot of the people are like, I've become a lot more productive in certain ways. In other ways, I wish I was in the lab because I just don't have at home what I had in the lab. But in other ways, I'm way more productive. So I guess my thing is, like, should everyone exit this time with a modified culture? Or was going back okay?
We're talking about technology, and I still think there's a lot of people, even though technology is affecting every single part of our lives and every field there is, that it has some play, but there's still a lot of people there is still a significant amount of people out there that do not embrace technology, or they're just not good with it. They're not comfortable with it. That will want to go back to that office type of culture. They feel more comfortable in it. And I don't know if that equates to better performance, to your point. So a comfort versus performance, I don't know. I think we'll just have to see, right? I think that's to be determined. We might not see that for another 2 years, right? About how that balances out. But I think a lot of companies are not going to, I don't see how they can force it. I think most companies are going to have to realize that if you're going back into the office and you do not see any performance, like, why are they paying all that expensive real estate, depending on the rent, right?
Randy, it's a kind of follow-up question you can answer, but I'll equate it to, like, I use the NFL a lot, so was going to an office like the 40-yard dash in the NFL combine, like, it was a piece of the performance puzzle, right? Like, there's a piece of the performance puzzle that got removed, right? And I know this as a fact, right? Like, showing up for some people is a big piece of the performance puzzle. Like, but showing up, walking around and chit-chatting all day, like, that's not performance. Yeah, you showed up, but we're not on The Sopranos where you break out your beach chair and sit at the job site. Like, that's not the business we're in, right? So showing up and just taking up a seat doesn't equal performance. So yeah, when you show up and that helps you perform better, I agree. But to me, my concern is that we return back to showing up being part of the performance metric. And showing up should be a personal thing that says, I can perform better because if I show up at the office, I can interact with these people better. I can get more accomplished. I can connect with people who I'm at an important point in a project or something that needs me to connect with these people physically. And we can get more accomplished in a shorter period of time if we're in that environment. Yeah, by all means, you should be in that office. Or I need to learn from my peers. Yeah, you should be there because just that culture of clustering together will allow you to grow faster. That's 100%. My concern is, is that a check the box that like is somehow, if the performance meter is 0 to 100, you're at 25 because you check the, I got to the office by 7 box.
So
like, what do you think, Rand?
For me, speaking from experience, I think like eight and a half years ago when I was first started here, if I were working remotely 100% of the time, I don't think I'd still be here. Like I don't think that I would have grown to where I am today. I think being in the office was helpful for me because I sat next to you, Tom, Justin, Linsky. Like I would listen to that, you know, and not that I eavesdrop, but listen to them on the phone or just see how, you know, everyone kind of interacted or, you know, just listening to, you know, customer problems and issues while you're talking out loud. You know, I think I learned a lot just from being there. Going in, like when I used to go in on Fridays, I would go in 5 days a week and I would learn from being there, I think. And I think it's a lot different being, you know, fast forward 8-9 years later, I don't feel the need to be in every day because I know I can do my job from anywhere. So I think it's different when you're starting out versus when you know, you're pretty seasoned. But I see what you're saying with, you know, check the box thing. Well, I was there, so I was working.
But you had, in that description you just gave, you realized that you basically said you were there because it was part of the performance culture. It's kind of like if you, you know, if you're already running a fast 40-yard dash, right, your maintenance to maintain that is far lower than what it takes to get there, right? The same way, if you're already deadlifting 400 pounds, your maintenance to continue deadlifting 400 pounds is far less than what it takes to get there. So all you're doing is saying, listen, I wanted to perform. And in order to perform, I knew I had to put this in. My motivation was performance. It wasn't showing up at the office because to me, that's an intensely personal thing. It's not a mandate that you can make because the minute you mandate it, and this is the final question, the minute you mandate it, you have an unaligned motivational message, which is you got to be here to punch the clock. It's no, like in no way do you have any, is that aligned with what your motivation is or what our motivation is? It's here because I want you to be here. Now it's on me to kind of like marshal you through your day. Like, I don't want to do that. So my final question is, what motivates you? How do you think your motivations align with, you know, your peers and subordinates? And do you think motivational alignment or lack thereof has a positive or negative impact on organizational culture? So to kind of distill that is like, what are you motivated by? Do you think a common motivation is important in building a good culture? Randy, you can go first.
Okay. So I guess this is a question I've always had trouble answering, I think, but, for me, I'm a people pleaser. I think I actually do think I'm motivated by helping everyone else. So just making sure, you know, our customers are happy, you know, we're operationally, we're on par with what we want to be doing. And I think I also, for me lately, I like just kind of figuring things out on my own. I mean, maybe it's not even lately. It's just kind of over the last few years, just trying to figure out what needs to get done, how to do it, just doing it without really, you know, any asking for help. It's like, but I think that that does motivate me a little bit. And I do think that for the people that I work with, I think that they, I think they also are motivated by figuring things out, because we are an innovative team, right? So just trying to learn on our own without getting the answers from someone else. I think that keeps our culture positive. I think we have a positive culture in that way.
How about you, Mike?
Well, I want to buy nice things. I guess at different points, like, again, I think everybody has different motivations at different points in their life. I think for me, at least, especially since, you know, where I was at before, it became very monotonous and complacency amongst everybody and all. And I realized that a good motivation, one of the reasons I was very excited to come here, my motivation was like, I want to just do different things. I want to learn new things. I want to learn about new technology. I want to be around people that are excited about new technology and share in that excitement and then talk about it and see if we could use it. Like whenever we post in our chat channels, you know, the group, hey, take a look at this. And I think that again, that empowerment for everybody to say, hey, listen, I just found this really cool technology and look at this and put it out there, and everybody looks and reads it. And then we compare about how cool it is. And, you know, again, it, could we even use it in a team for a customer or something? To me, that's all the something new all the time, the not the monotonous every day, same thing, right? So that, to me, it motivates me to like learn and experience new things like all the time. And if I can do that in the job, then that's great, right? And I definitely think that is, to Randy's point, I think we definitely have that's definitely an alignment with most of the people on the team, if not all. You know, they're a bunch of geeks, right? They're a bunch of techies, right? And I think that no matter what position you are on the team, there's still like a cool factor about like learning something new and some new technology. So I definitely think it helps. Yeah, I think there is an alignment with the team. It's a part of the culture. I think that you've driven in for the last 12 years, because I think it's a part of when we actually go and look for people, we want to have that excitement as well. And that helps feed, and it actually helps renewing the DNA of the team, right? Like somebody else would come in with some new ideas, somebody else would come in with some new technological experience, right? And you can share it with the team, and everybody's like, wow, that's really cool. So I think that to me, that's a good, that motivates me. And again, it was a good reason why I came over here and I'm really excited about that opportunity.
Yeah, it's great. I think there's I think we have a really healthy curiosity on our team. And it's funny, as people get more comfortable, which we said, right? Like people need to feel free to kind of voice their, as people get more comfortable on the team, right? And the culture either changes to meet them or they adopt more of the culture. They contribute a lot more. And we start to realize that, you know, because we're a curious bunch, they start to contribute things they're curious about, and then they pique our curiosity, and then we talk about it and debate it and, you know, poke each other a little, right? To just try to see how convicted we are, or whatever it might be, right? And that is, I think that is a determiner of a good culture. And it's definitely not a determiner of people who hopefully will leave this planet going, you know, I want to be remembered for enjoying the nice things I bought, right? I definitely want to be remembered for the curiosity and what I brought to the conversation, and, you know, hopefully something some little tidbit somebody else took away from some experience that we had together, right? Where as opposed to, and I was having a conversation last night with someone, I'll leave their name off this, but like to me, like I'm far more interested in somebody who just fixed up their broken Yugo, having a conversation with someone who just fixed up their broken Yugo, than I am to somebody who just bought a 911. Like I just am. Like I want to hear about like what you did all weekend and why the hell you repaired your Yugo. Like that to me is a far more interesting conversation than I had an extra $80,000 to blow. Like I don't really care. Like great. Like I know the car's fast. I'm sure it handles fabulously, but you haven't lived it. The person who decided to like repair their Yugo and fix all the body dents, bondo the thing, sand it down, give it a lime green paint job. Like I want to know that guy or girl.
Or
like everybody. Like, everybody wants a 911. Everybody. Oh, it's just a matter of do you have the cash to buy one or not.
Or the person that dropped like a 350 engine in a Yugo.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. Like that's an interesting conversation.
Right.
Like if I have to, I don't any like the person who buys a 911 or Bugatti or Lamborghini. I don't. The question of why never comes to my mind. Like. It might come to my mind if I know you don't have the cash, like then it's like, but I would, I'm not even sure I would ask why. I would just go, that's dumb. Okay. Let's move on. But like when I know somebody like put their sweat equity into something and it cost them very little, like there's just a much better dialogue. Like, I don't know, to me, it's far more interesting. And I feel like we have a lot of great people on the team who offer a lot in that area. Like even a couple of weeks ago, Harvey was talking about like, you know, how he's gamifying his life, like, you know, taking things he did and like seeing if he can do them by 5 minutes less. I'm like, that's pretty cool. Like, seems maybe hard to regiment that, but I mean, I'm sure if you're a gamer, like that might be a fun thing to do. Like, can I finish a little faster? Can I get a couple other people on the team to do the same thing and start to gamify stuff? I think it's pretty neat. All right, any parting words, Randy?
No, I really enjoyed this, though. This was, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Mike, any parting words?
I just want to say, I guess this was a good topic, session about culture. And, you know, we talked a lot about a lot of different things about culture, but I will say that I reiterate that I think we've got one of the best team cultures that I've kind of ever been around. Right. And maybe, you know, I don't know if that's because, you know, within human beings, you know, there's a certain amount of people you can still have that with, or can you expand that out? I'm curious to see how many people we can bring in and still keep that culture. I think we can do it. I think we can really grow it. But very happy to be here.
Well, I appreciate both of you. And I think in the final note, I think culture can always be awesome if we're all willing to change and to appreciate what other people bring to the party, right? And I think what's great about our culture is that people are willing to listen to each other and adopt new ideas. And for the most part, people don't take stuff too personal, right? It's because sometimes, especially during, and this is especially during this virtual time, the delta between what was typed and meant versus what was actually meant can be really far apart. And you got to learn to trust the culture, right? Trust the people you come to work with every day. Trust the people you call friends or peers or whatever. And know that they always have your best intention. You know, their best intention is always put forward, and they always have your best interest at heart, right? No one's looking to burn anyone. And I think if you show up like that every day, then there's no limit to like how big your culture can be. And the more people you put into it, the more diversity you put into it, the better it should become, right? Because hopefully none of us are so locked into like what's supposed to be the quote unquote norm that we we forget that, like, normal's a relative term. Like, hey, if you're an alien, it's normal to have a green head with a long, skinny neck. Like, that's normal. It may not be normal for human, but that's probably an evolved life form that got there for some reason. All right, well, great. You've both been great guests. I appreciate you. We ran a little over, but it was fun. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye, guys.
Have a good one. Bye-bye.